Health, if you like, becomes fetishized. It becomes a commodity. It's pursued and acquired for its own sake, according to the logic of exchange, without respect to persons, practices, or resources available. Hence my point about it actually, the pursuit of health in our culture actually generates unhealth. But it's not just the unhealth of the person, it's the unhealth of society, because it instrumentalizes all relationships. That autonomy principle that we were speaking about yesterday needs to be carefully watched, because the autonomy principle, if it trumps every other principle, instrumentalizes healthcare providers and professionals. That's why conscience is such a critical element in the whole care relationship, because what conscience does is it means that I am not ultimately instrumentalized. That means that you can trust me, that I can operate with integrity and with judgment and with truth, because conscience is about the priority of truth in our lives. And so precisely there, that freedom that of conscience is one way in which we can stop that erosion. But that too, I think, is under threat. So this unhealthy society eventually etiolates our relationships, so that what happens is we're left with the human is taken out, and we're left with a culture, a system, which is largely mechanical, highly bureaucratized, and in fact loses its own humanity. Okay, that's one picture, and we can nuance that, and I'm sure you would want to nuance it, but I think you can see what I'm after. Within that, then, we come to religion. And I want to suggest that religion is also made to serve this vision of health. So what's the place of religion in all of this? And it's one of the most interesting features about how religion comes into play with health. We saw it yesterday with Sir Cyril Chandler talking about Harold Koenig. If you look at Harold Koenig's very excellent work, which demonstrates empirically that religion, faith, spirituality is good for your health. But the overall impact of that is to say, why should we have religion in health? Not because it's true, but because it's good for us, because it produces better health. And hence, what I'm suggesting is religion comes into healthcare not on its own terms, but again in a purely instrumentalized relationship. And that's part of the secularization of faith. Now, the secular world produces its own version of faith. It's called spirituality very often. And that's part of the commodification of religion and faith that takes place. Suddenly, people discover that they're more than bodies, that they have relationships and histories and emotions and thoughts and also soul, and that they have beliefs and they are searching. But the discovery of religion isn't about recognizing that wholeness, it's about producing health. And so religion and spirituality itself becomes disembodied from the community out of which it arises. Hence you get generic spirituality. Hence you get spiritual caregivers that in fact are detached from their faith communities. And therefore you get professionalized relationships which serve, if you like to put it very sort of starkly, serve another god. So, again, the relationship becomes divorced from meaning and the vision of the human person and their destiny before God. What happens is, then, religion fits into a cause-effect relationship, which is essentially a reductive relationship for us, because it suits science. It doesn't suit theology. But from that point of view, what you've actually done is if it's a purely cause-effect relationship, you've converted religion into magic, because that's what magic is about. And so what you've done is you've introduced a sort of secular magic into the thing. So religion itself is transformed. And what happens then is religion becomes less about reshaping our desires, about conversion, and it becomes more a way of fulfilling them. So that commodification of religion also requires, part of the process of that is also, strangely, making our culture more ignorant of religion. Because religion isn't, therefore, part of our culture and accepted because of its meaning, because of its truth, but simply because of its therapeutic effect. I don't need, if you like, to know the truth value of this. I only need to know that it works. So it's against that, then, and that sort of critique, that we come to the question, which is the theme of our conference, about faith in health. So I want to argue, why should we have faith in health? First of all, I want to suggest to you that the reason why we have faith in health is precisely to keep our health care really healthy, by keeping it really human, by keeping it personal in the best sense. And also it means that the presence of genuine faith in health is also actually a link with community. It's a refusal to be disembedded from the community and the history of the community in which we live. So it's a part of a resistance to instrumentalization. So faith in health is a life-giving subversion of the commodification of health. And so it doesn't undermine it, it becomes a good partner, and at times it becomes the guardian of its central values. Now, part of the way in which we come to that, as I was saying a little bit this morning, it's part of a bigger question about where religion does fit in our secular culture. And to summarise a sort of complicated argument, to sort of put that in context, because we're living it. Every hospital, every GP, every healthcare centre actually has to deal with these. It focuses usually for us on the ethical questions, where faith, the vision of faith, very often comes into conflict or tension with what's needed, or what people want, or with the questionable notion of health. This question of where religion is in the public sphere, there is an assumption that the public space should be neutral space. And of course, neutral space is defined by the secular, with the assumption that the secular is really neutral. Now, we know that the secular isn't neutral. We know that it is also a creed and an ideology in some ways, and that's okay. Then another way of looking at it is, well, we'll let religion into this public space, but we will insist that it must have arguments that are publicly accessible, that they're open to reason and they're open to verification and to question. And that's fine too, and that's very congenial to a sort of Catholic tradition. Except there's one problem with that, that very often the very basis of our reasons are based on revelation and the privileged insight that revelation gives us. And so there's a way in which the very basis of our arguments can't always be publicly accessible. And in any case, we'd want to say, fine, whose reason? There are different models of rationality. In fact, the whole of our faith system is profoundly respectful of reason and rationality. But it simply takes different premises, as it has to. So, this leaves us with that problem of how we witness in this public space, with our reasons, which are not irrational, with our sense, which sometimes won't make sense to the world that doesn't have this vision of faith. Now, what I would want to suggest here is this doesn't mean to say that we shy away from this. My argument would be that, in fact, we become more who we are, not less who we are. And the reason I suggest that is there comes a point where we can have our reasons, but it's actually our example and our witness, if you like, that creates a new space. Example of this would be one of our generals, Father Pedro Arrupe, who generally regarded as a very holy man, worked for a large part of his life in Japan. And he was present there through Hiroshima and all the horrors of Nagasaki. And one Japanese man, old man, was talking about Arrupe, and he said, he instructed me in the faith. So, you know, he had this very deep personal regard for Arrupe. And he said, I don't think I understood a word that he said to me. But he was such a good man that I wanted to be in touch with his goodness. And I think that's an insight, that by being our faith in health, by being who we are, by living by our values, we can negotiate this public space. But we can do more than that. We can actually introduce other possibilities into it which preserve its own integrity. So let me just suggest what some of these might be very briefly. I think that the NHS is an extraordinary achievement which does enshrine these great values that we've been talking about this morning. The Darzi Report offers a constitution, and the constitution states all these extraordinary values, particularly respect, dignity, compassion. But actually, constitutions can't guarantee them. They might set a framework, but they can't guarantee them. What we need is we need to incarnate those values, to live them, to profess them, and to witness to them. And this is where I would say faith in health becomes significant. Because what is the great virtue of our healthcare system? I would say it is gratuity, absolute gratuity, in the fullest, most practical, and in the most spiritual sense. Because gratuity creates the space for healing. We flourish not because we can control something, or we can achieve health, or we can achieve what we want through our own power. We flourish because of gratuity, because we're given it. We're given the possibilities. We're given the space. We're given the gift, if you like. So a society which is purely operates purely on economic relationships, which are based on an instrumental understanding of exchange, there is an absence of gratuity in that society. It's a society in which people cannot flourish because they don't have the space in which to flourish. So gratuity takes us beyond the calculus of economic resources. And it says you can have security, especially when you are most vulnerable, especially when you're facing disease or despair or depression, or especially when you're facing death. And it's sheer gratuity because it's on the basis of need that care is offered, not on status, not on power, not on wealth. And this is an extraordinary reversal of that relationship of exchange, because it allows us to be human and it allows us to be generous, so that we're no longer purely technicians or professionals. We are human mediators of this gratuity. And that's true especially when we are elderly and vulnerable and disabled. We're saying that society has a space for me, and I'm not just a burden, that I am also valued. That is sheer gratuity. Christian life is about that gratuity. It's based on this extraordinary, wonderful exchange when God becomes human. One of the great images of Christ, right throughout the Fathers, in all the traditions, the Eastern traditions, the Western traditions, the great Syriac tradition, is of the Christ who is the physician, Christ who is the healer. Augustine speaks of this Christ who is the healer, and he says, one of the problems with physicians is they think they've got help. They think they've got it right. They think they can cure you. But actually they discover that they can't, because they don't know the disease. They don't know what it is to be human. We don't have that capacity. The only person who has that capacity, and why he is the great healer, is Christ, because he has become one of us. And more than that, he has made us. So we bring to this forum this image, this resource of Christ the physician, who heals us not just at a bodily level or even at a soul level, but heals us at the deepest level of recognizing that we are persons, that we are included, that we have a destiny, that we have, if you like, a purpose. And one of the points about that insistence on destiny and vocation is that it's simply not an add-on to what it is to be human. It is what it is to be human, because our destiny is part of our history and it's part of our identity. So we bring that. We bring also this practice of compassion. We spoke, the Cardinal spoke a little bit about that this morning. But I would want to say, if we really want a healthcare system that has compassion, apart from what the Cardinal was saying, then it seems to me that we actually have to prioritize it practically. And one of the things we... compassion requires time. You have to take time to give time. And that means that you have time. And that means ultimately that you have to buy time. It means that you can't afford, if you really want compassion and quality care, it means you have to create the space for that. So you don't overburden people with bureaucracy. You don't use wards. You give people the time that they need to be human and to be generous. The Christian perspective on health says this, that health is a good, but it's not an absolute good. That health is, if you like, it's a gift, it's a grace, it's contingent. But part and parcel of what the Christian vision brings to this is how also to live well with sickness, how to have life in sickness. And that's part of a discovery of dependency. We live in a culture that is terrified of dependency, and yet it is one of the greatest gifts. It is one of the greatest sources of gratuity. Finally, hospitality, from which it all originates. If you think about hospitality and what it brings refuge, it brings safety, it brings care, it brings welcome, it brings gift. Hospitality is not simply about health, it is about life, even where there's death. What we offer is that hospitality because Christ has given us that hospitality. By giving us a place in his life, he has given us refuge, safety, care, welcome, gift, and healing. And he has created that, and it's that that we also create through our witness and through our faith. Finally, Augustine says, beautiful phrase, that we are touched sometimes by an everywhere present truth. I want to suggest that to be touched by that truth, to be touched by that gratuity, is to be touched by life and to enter into a new experience of health. It's to be that touch is what we are called to be. And I believe that the quiet, professional, and dedicated work that we are called to do, the work of value and of integrity, is so that everyone may discover and benefit from that health-giving that is faith, so that faith in health becomes the health that is faith.